For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Hey, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, this slightly nasal, quasi-raspy voice is Matt Tebbe, and I'm joined by Ben Sturkey.
I don't know how you'd, I don't feel very nasal, but I'll let our listeners be the judge of that.
No, you have like a Mr. Rogers vibe, and I've got a different vibe going on today. Yeah. I can't get this schmutz out of my throat. Can I say schmutz?
I think so.
Is that appropriation?
I honestly don't know.
All jokes aside, I'm realizing that I want to be more sensitive to phrases or memes or things that are not mine to appropriate.
Yeah, that's good.
I come by appropriation, honestly. I come from a long line of colonizers, Ben.
Yes, as a white man.
It's what I do best.
Yeah.
No, man, it's good to see you.
You as well. My friend, I just got back into working out this week.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No more deadlifts, though.
No more deadlifts.
Stay away from those deadlifts.
Injured my back pretty bad, so I've got a trauma response now every time I see one of those. I got back into working out. My back is feeling better.
Good.
So yeah, I'm good. Hopeful. I'm sweaty right now. Is why I'm thinking about it. I just worked out.
I just thought you were nervous to record this intro.
Oh no! Yeah, sweating, just pouring down my face.
So my dad messaged me last night, and he ruptured his hamstring.
Oh my gosh!
And
bad.
I called him. I was like, "Dad, what happened?" Well, my dad moved to Tennessee, and he has never played golf really in his life. And he's got all these friends now who play golf, and they invite him to play golf. The first time he plays golf, he hits a ball into the river. And he goes down to the riverside, and he's got a ball retriever. He's trying to get his ball out. He puts his foot on what he thought was a dry rock, and it wasn't dry, and he slipped like a Looney Tunes, like his foot slipped out in front of him, and he did the splits. A 70-year-old man did the splits in the river, and he ruptured his hamstring. It was. Poor guy. Yeah. He probably won't play golf again. And anyway, he's healing up. He just met with the doctor today, and I'm going to give him a call here later and just check in on him.
All right.
So stay away from slippery rocks, dude.
Deadlifts, slippery rocks.
Yeah.
And probably just golf in general. So
I don't know. I like playing golf. It's a sport of leisure, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
You got to have tons of leisure to play it.
Tons of leisure and usually a lot of money, too.
So, yes.
Yeah.
Speaking of leisure and money.
Yeah.
No? No. Well,
not quite. You didn't quite get there. Good try. It was a good try.
Kat Armas has nothing to do with leisure and money in golfing. She has written a book, Abuelita Faith, What Women on the Margins Teach Us About Wisdom, Persistence, and Strength. This book is great. She is a wicked smart Bible scholar, And she also tells kind of her story as a Cuban American growing up in Miami and reading scripture as a Cuban American female living mm-hmm. in Miami. And I don't know. I really appreciate people who are have a different perspective, bring different questions, bring different experiences, notice different things from scripture than I do, just because mm-hmm. of how God has placed them in the world and how yeah. they show up there.
Yeah.
And Kat is one of those people, and our conversation was riveting.
Yeah, it was. It was really great.
So get ready to be riveted. I'm not sure if you're into that, but
ready to be, yeah, if you know, it's, maybe the riveting is optional.
Yeah.
But yes. Also wanted to say, if you are not part of our, Matt, I want to say this directly to you.
Okay.
This time, if you are not part of our online community,
oh,
you'll know it because you won't get an email from me on Fridays.
Mm.
Are you a part of our online community, Matt?
Ben, I have a confession.
Okay.
And I've been waiting actually to bring this up to you, and I've never really had the right time to do it. So
okay.
I'm glad you initiated this.
A public podcast intro is probably relief. The very appropriate time.
I'm feeling all kinds of relief, and I haven't Good. Even said this yet, but I've been on the email list for a long time.
That's great.
Yep.
That's great.
For a long time, I've been getting these emails, and I've told you, you know what I've told you about these emails. You have the gift of emails.
The gift
There's
of emails.
Something about how you do that thing you do. I like so much about who you choose to be. No, it's really good, man. I mean,
yeah.
I unsubscribe from emails. I got a friend who subscribes me to emails. Like, mm-hmm. he subscribed me to MyPillow mailing list.
This is the funniest way of trolling somebody.
Dude,
in my mind.
He signed me up for, who was it? The DeSantis governor of Florida, his reelection campaign.
MyPillow. That's wonderful.
If you have a friend ideas. And you want to troll them, take uh-huh. their email and just sign them up for the most asinine, inane lists yeah. you can think of.
Yeah.
And
if there's no double opt-in required, then they're signed up. There they
well,
go.
Well, so. I unsubscribe from MyPillow, but he keeps okay. sending me coupons. So if you're looking to support that guy, just hit me up.
I got coupons. I got some coupons.
Discount coupons.
Yes.
All right, we should get into Kat, huh?
We should, yeah. If you do want to get on our email list, though,
oh right.
The one that Matt the one that appreciates I just, so much.
Well, I just got it off my chest that I have. Yeah, I'm a subscriber. Yeah,
I'm sure you feel better.
I do.
Just go to gravityleadership.com/join, and you can give us your email address, and we will send you great emails.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Once a week, usually.
Once a week, yeah. We send you an email once a week, and it's got curated links for leaders and for people who are. Yeah, interested in kind of constructing a faith worth living here in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit of an extension of our podcast. Some of these conversations kind of find their way into the emails. So
yes.
Anyway, join us there.
All right.
I think that's probably good enough.
That's good enough.
For this intro?
Yep.
All right.
Let's get into it.
Let's hear from Kat.
Bless today and thank you for this great book. Kat Armus, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, Kat, she has her own podcast called The Protagonistas, where she hosts conversations and tells stories of everyday women of color. And she's written for Christianity Today, Sojourners, Relevant, Christians for Biblical Equality, Fuller Youth Institute, and Missio Alliance, among other places. And she speaks regularly on race and justice. Kat, anything else we need to know about you? What are some of the things that don't make the back of the book?
Yeah, well, I mean, the entire book is about my experience as a Cuban American person. So I would say that is, you know, just the lens from which I speak and the lens from which I write and all of those things. But yeah, I mean, besides that, I am, you know, a wife, I'm about to be a mother for the first time. So that's exciting. Cool. And yeah. And, you know, a forever student. I feel like I am a forever student of, you know, all things theology. So yeah.
Mm. Yeah, which comes through in this book. We're going to talk about your latest book that was published with Brazos called Abuelita Faith. Did I butcher that? Abuelita?
No, you got it. I love listening to non-Spanish speakers say abuelita. It's not an easy word to say.
Yeah, Abuelita Faith. What women on the margins teach us about wisdom, persistence, and strength. This book is sort of a, it's sort of four parts in my mind, and I'd love to hear if I've picking up what you're doing here. It's basically your sort of your autobiography. It's a biography of your grandmother and your family. It's a history, an anecdotal history of Latin America and Cuba. And then it's also a Cuban-American look at women in scripture and telling their story through not only your story, but the stories of the women that you've been proximal to. Is this... Did I get
it? Yeah, I think you did a great job. Yeah. I try and do a lot and sort of weave in history and my history, my ancestors, right? Latin American history. And also our ancestors in scripture, the women, our foremothers who have come before us and who have paved the way. So trying to tell a lot of stories and just argue that, you know, some of the greatest theologians the world has ever known are those whom the world wouldn't consider theologians. And so, yes. Yeah.
Yes. And I want to get into it, a couple of those stories later, but first let's start with, if it's okay, your story. I think you were born and raised in Miami. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As a Cuban American, and you were raised Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. And then at some point, it seems like college or just after college, you fell in with some Christians, Kat.
With some Protestant white evangelical Christians, yes.
Yeah. What was it about white evangelicalism coming from a Cuban kind of Roman Catholic background? What was it about white evangelicalism that appealed to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's funny, Miami as a city, you know, is not very, it's very Roman Catholic, obviously. And so a lot of the religious or sort of the churches that you're going to run into, if they're not Roman Catholic, they're going to be, you know, small immigrant, Pentecostal maybe churches. But at some point, you know, I think it was like the Calvary Chapel movement sort of made its way, the non-denominational movement sort of entered the space, and it was pretty brand new. So that was actually part of my story, was that I started, I saw a radio station being promoted, a Christian radio station. I thought that was interesting. You know, I've always considered myself a Christian person. Obviously, you know, Roman Catholic, but I still was interested in the things of God and spirituality, of course. So I saw this radio station being promoted on the back of a car or something. So I tuned in, and it was one of the first, you know, Christian Protestant, to be specific, radio stations. And they were sort of just, you know, playing your very generalized white evangelical sort of sermons and songs, you know, the Hill songs and all that sort of stuff. And I wasn't familiar with any of that. But I got, you know, I was interested. And I think the movement sort of got popular with younger, you know, younger Cubans, more Americanized, the younger generation. And yeah, and I was just sort of interested in it. Because it was very different than what I was used to, very different than what I was accustomed to in my, you know, Roman Catholic upbringing. And I thought its messages were interesting, you know, all about like making the most out of your life and, you know, and all of these things. And I thought that was, they were interesting messages. So that's sort of how I got into it. It was really just listening to this radio station, listening to sermons on my way to work and, you know, from work and class and things like that. And then there was a conference that they were promoting and I thought, oh, I'll go, you know, and I talk a little bit about it in my book, but that was the first time that I was really, you know, I ended up going to this conference. It was like 6 months after I had started listening to the radio station and, you know, people were eyes closed, hands up, you know, Jesus on the Jumbotron screen. And I had never seen anything like that, you know, the lasers and the lights. And it was just very intriguing for me as a young, you know, in my early 20s, it was just very interesting for me and very intriguing. And the messages were, you know, again, it was very much, you know, being a young in your 20s, I was, you know, full of angst and what do I want to do with my life? And listening to people like Christine Kane and Francis Chan, you know, talk about giving it all up for Jesus and, you know, all these things. And so I was, you know, I was all in. I think the community and the intensity, right, of the message. Yes. And the people and the young people, I think, really captivated me. And but I didn't know, you know, the ins and outs of it. I didn't know the history. I didn't know anything other right. than, oh, wow, this is very interesting. So, yeah, that's a little bit of how I got into it.
Yeah. Yeah. I can relate to that. I was raised Roman Catholic, and in college kind of fell in with some Christians. They didn't have a radio station, but they had guitars and yeah. an evening group. And, right. I just never met Christians, from my Catholic experience. I'd never met Christians my age who took Jesus seriously.
Right.
And
yeah.
it was something passionate. There was an ardor and a zealousness and a fervor that felt contagious, right? There was a contagiousness right. to it, an energy to it. And I think it took me almost 15 years to begin to wake up to, oh, there's some things they didn't tell me about.
Right.
There's some things I didn't get at the door when I came in. Mm-hmm. And you have a way into, I think, the genesis of this book. I don't know if this book happens. Maybe it does, but it seems like a really important things happened to you when you went to seminary mm-hmm. as a Cuban American woman, where you felt like you began to be confronted explicitly with some of the things that weren't named when you first came into the faith. Could you maybe describe what that was and the impact that had on you?
Yeah, definitely. And so, as I was saying, yeah, I wasn't too familiar, you know, with the ins and outs of evangelicalism. But I quickly was like, I think I want to, you know, pursue this. I want to pursue ministry. And I, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I'm, you know, a forever student, a forever learner. And so I just, you know, began reading the Bible and commentaries and all these things. And I really wanted to learn more. And so I thought, oh, you know, New Orleans has a seminary. It's a cool place to live. I'll move there. I didn't know that it was Southern Baptist. I didn't know what that meant. And so I ended up, yeah, at this seminary where, you know, coming fresh out of Miami, where my culture is part of the dominant culture, you know, raised by women, you know, a single mother and a single grandmother, where, you know, it's just very different the way that you carry yourself and the way that you, just and in the book, I sort of argue that a lot of it's just survival, you know, like my grandmother and my mother just had to like provide and do all the things because they had no other choice. And so that's what I was sort of raised to, you know, be or so I get to this setting where, you know, I was literally one of three people of color, you know, non-culturally white person. And also I was, you know, again, fresh out of Miami. And so I wasn't used to these very set, you know, hierarchical or gender sort of norms. I wasn't used to that. And so I think a lot of folks didn't know what to do with me, you know, because I didn't come in with predisposed ideas of how I was supposed to act or
anything. Yeah, you didn't have the operating system, the right operating system to run that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was hard, you know, it was really, really hard. Because I, you know, of course I get there and I think, oh, these are the things that I need to do. And in order to be a right, you know, Christian or a right follower of God. And I began to believe that, oh my goodness, everything that I learned about God up until this point was wrong. You know, my grandmother's going to hell. Oh my goodness. You know, everybody in my community has gotten it all wrong my entire life. You know, it was a huge existential sort of crisis that I experienced. And yeah, and then having to like try and retrain just everything about myself, thinking I needed to do that. And so, yeah, I think that was a very jarring experience for me, you know, and really just wrestling with my identity, who I am. And a lot of it obviously was centered around who I am as a woman and who I am as a Cuban American woman, you know, because I think had I been raised in a culture where, you know, my culture wasn't the dominant culture, maybe it would have felt differently. But it was those two things, right? Ethnicity and gender. And they just sort of just clashed at the same time, along with me trying to figure out, wait a minute, you know, now that I'm super passionate about this sort of spirituality, how does that all come together?
Yeah, it strikes me that had it not been for sort of the strong sort of matriarchal culture you grew up in, that right. you wouldn't have been as impervious to the patriarchy and right. sort of the white centric way of doing theology and ordering bodies and the norms and all the expectations. It almost seems like I mean, and this comes out in your book, like the legacy your grandma lived into you was sort of your, she was sort of your vaccine, like in seminary. Like she sort of was this inoculation against this white patriarchal norming, so that you had, I mean, the way you tell the story, you almost had this allergic response.
Yeah. Yeah, no, sort of, I think that that's, I love the way that you frame that. She was sort of like my vaccine. I think that that's right. I think that's, you're right about that. Because of, you know, the strong, I mean, I was raised by women that, you know, I didn't have any men in my life. And again, it was just because of death and a lot of different circumstances. But yeah, and I think, again, what I was saying earlier about this idea of survival, I mean, you know, when you're just trying to survive, particularly in, you know, in my culture, there was, it's immigrant, you know, there's a lot of immigrant, it's an immigrant community. I mean, you can't really prescribe to a lot of these things because it just doesn't work, you know, like there's no, there's really just no framework for it. And not to say that my culture is not, you know, we don't wrestle with machismo and we don't wrestle with a lot of, you know, things like that. It's not to say that, you know, that's not pervasive in my culture at all. It's just to say that in my specific, the way that I was raised specifically, and yeah, I mean, women just had to do all the things, you know? And yeah, so I think that it was when I, and I also say that because I wasn't raised in white evangelicalism, I think it was easier for me to spot a lot of these things. You know, I feel like there's a lot of people who it takes, you know, it just takes longer because that's just how you're, you know, what you're used to your entire life. And so, yeah, you're right. I did have a sort of allergic reaction. You know, I say that I quickly, you know, I stepped into, or I stumbled into white evangelicalism, and then I quickly, you know, left because it was very clear for me because of the way that I was raised. So I think you're right about that.
Yeah. Kat, could, I wonder if you could give, that's certainly true in, I think for me as a white, I grew up in this space and I sort of, it's made for me, you know, as a white man. And so it took me a long time to recognize sort of some of the toxicity or some of the problematic elements of this. Can you name for us one or two artifacts of this clash that happened for you? Like one or two stories or just artifact, like how did you notice this? And what was it that helped you see, oh, I don't know if this is a space that really wants me here or as me, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great name question. Yeah, I think a lot of those things, you know, a lot of these instances happened when I was, for example, in the classroom, right? In a very formal space where, you know, you're expected to sort of like learn all these things about God. And I just remember, you know, I was taught to just speak up and be confident about, you know, and work hard and just sort of do all the things that anybody else would do.
Right.
And I think that, you know, like as I mentioned, kind of rubbed a lot of my professors the wrong way. Just a lot of folks didn't know what to do with that. I was called
with you
out.
Speaking up.
Yeah, just yeah, kind of like mean, having yeah, okay. an opinion. And yeah, and I, yeah. I remember, you know, and yeah, and just pushing back against things, you know. Yeah. But I remember in one of my classes, it was a I mentioned this in the book, but it was a hermeneutics class, and my professor, you know, was talking about learning Greek and Hebrew and how important it is if you're going to teach and all that stuff, you know, which of course I agreed with. And I'm here like, yeah, nodding along, you know, cause I was taking obviously the languages, and all of a sudden, you know, he kind of said, turned the corner and said, and ladies, you know, your husbands will be very impressed with you if you can exegete scripture along, you know, and it was so jarring to hear that. First of all, I wasn't married at that time. And then second of all, I'm just like, what? So what am I doing here? Like, why am I sitting here and like, you know, spending as much time studying and reading and like for what? So my husband can be my future husband that I may not even have one day can be, you know, impressed,
can be
with
impressed
me.
With you. Yeah.
Right. And
it's
then
a lot
I remember
of money to impress your husband.
Right. And it was just so bizarre. You know, I had never, I couldn't believe that. And then he literally finished that with right cat, you know, because I was just like, cause he knew that I was very, you know, and yeah, it was just a lot of experiences like that. You know, I had, another pastor who I write this in the story as well, but I, you know, wanted to get together with a group of young women to read the Bible. And he just, you know, labeled me suspect from the second I got to his church, you know, just because I was like I made the initiative to like read the Bible with, I don't know, you know, started spreading rumors about me saying that I was unsubmissive. And I had never, I didn't understand what that term meant. What do you mean unsubmissive? Like, what is that? Who, to who, you know, obviously to him. And in his interpretation of that, being unsubmissive to him was unsubmissive to God. Right. So yeah, so you know, a lot of these little experiences that, you know, I remember one day, because I have light skin, right? And so one day I was sitting with a group of women, you know, and I said something like, yes, you know, I'm white. And I was talking about the fact that, you know, my skin, you know, it have light skin tone. And they all looked at me, you're not white, you know, and it wasn't in a way to, you know, it wasn't in a bad way or whatever, but it was very clear, like, no, you're not, you know, you're not one of us. Like, it's very clear that you come from a different place. Just from the way that I carried myself and the way that I, just was. Yeah. And so a lot of these little instances, you know, you start to, you know, especially that I came from a culture where I was the dominant culture, you know, I share in the book of how, I was in a, this was later on, I was in a, the Hispanic Summer Institute, and I was taking a class, and a lot of the students had transferred from Latin America, and, or they were international students, and they, this idea of being a person of color was very new to them. They're like, what do you mean? You know, like, I'm just a person, you know? And it was a very new thing to deal with being in the US. And I felt the same way coming from Miami, you know, because I was part of the dominant culture. I never wrestled with my ethnic identity outside of Miami until I arrived here. And it was very obvious, right? It was like within days, you know? So yeah, those are some of the experiences right off the bat, you know?
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
It's really interesting to me that, like, you, like, just, I mean, just to be frank, like, you look at a picture of you and, you know, you could be sort of white. You know what I mean? Like, in the sense of, like, very light skin and, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But it's interesting to me that, like, the people that knew you there, it was very quickly just, you know, the way that you were with them, it registered to them that, oh, you're not part of this thing. No. You don't act like us. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, that's a fascinating insight. You're not from here, are you? Yeah.
And that was, you know, my experience in this hermeneutics class. I'm learning about how to exegete scripture and how to read the Bible. And everything is from a framework of whiteness, right? Everything is from a framework of, my professor, you know, was from rural Mississippi, which is wildly different than, you know, big city Miami, you know? Right. And everybody understood what he was saying when he was teaching. Everyone's like, oh yeah, I get these cultural, you know, whatever. Because a lot of people were from that general area, or if not, you know, were familiar with it. I had no idea, you know? And so I'm like, so what does this have to do with me? You know, and not that there's anything wrong with that, with obviously being from rural Mississippi, but when you can't connect with that, how am I supposed to, you know, relate? And not just relate, but as someone who wants to teach and, you know, how am I supposed to glean anything? You know, so.
And the problem there, right, is not from being, the problem isn't being white or being from rural Mississippi,
right.
But the problem is when that is seen as the only authoritative or legitimate,
the normal
thing.
Right.
Yeah. It's the right thing. It's the only thing. It's, you know, here you need to conform to these standards in order to be legitimized.
Right.
Yeah. And so then, Kat, you describe your work in the book as dissent, that you realized at this, and I think you quote kind of an axiomatic saying that your very existence was resistance to sort of the prevailing white hegemony that had set itself up in Western Christianity. And so then could we like pivot a bit? Because I think the theological work of this book is so necessary, so helpful for me, so helpful for others. But you very consciously start the book with understanding that you are attempting, this is a project of decolonized reading of Scripture. I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with deconstruction, but not as much decolonization. Would you describe how you understand decolonization and how this project is a work of that?
Yeah, definitely. And so there are different ways that you can understand or look at or investigate, you know, decolonization, decolonial theory, those sort of things. So for me, in my book, I kind of tackle it from the idea of knowledge or wisdom. You know, what is knowledge? What is wisdom? Who gets to say, you know, who is wise, right?
Yeah.
And sort of what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to look at, you know, non-Western ways of being and knowing in the world that aren't, you know, don't come from the dominant culture. Now, you know, I do say in the book, like, I am a Western person. I mean, there's no way that I'm not, you know,
right.
I am a Western person. So anything that I say, of course, you know, it's that wrestling, that me trying to also, you know, see things from a non-Western way of being and knowing. And so in the book, what I'm looking at is, you know, the ways that my grandmother engaged in ways of being and knowing that weren't shaped by the dominant culture. Also, you know, I'm looking at readings and understandings of Scripture that aren't shaped by the dominant culture. And I'm also looking at my own ancestors, right? I look at the Taino people of the Caribbean who, you know, whom were the original peoples of Cuba and that area, the general Caribbean area. And also, you know, just that in general. And so that's what I'm doing. And I'm sort of saying, like, where does wisdom come from? You know, when we think of biblical wisdom, or we think of people who are wise in dominant culture, we think of formal education, or we think of right interpretations of Scripture, or we think of, you know, a lot of these things. And so I'm sort of arguing, like, well, you know, is that how, you know, we've seen wisdom throughout history, you know? And so that's what I'm sort of trying to investigate. You know, for example, you know, and I sort of play with these things in the Bible, like the Hebrew midwives, right? I mean, they were obviously wise, you know, because, you know, they were people who saved, you know, they saved the entire people and whatever, you know, I mean, we know most of us know their story, but I think what's so interesting about the Hebrew midwives is that, you know, this idea of midwifery in the ancient world was a spiritual practice. I mean, they were spiritual leaders and healers, and it was more than just, oh, they delivered babies, but they did rituals and they were looked at with respect. And so I'm thinking, you know, it's funny because in the dominant culture's eyes nowadays, we'd look at, you know, women like this and we would think they were maybe pagan or they were, you know, but this is the wisdom that they possessed. And God, you know, called them righteous, essentially, right? And so I'm looking at different ways of knowing and being in the world, you know, and in my grandmother's sense, my grandmother's story, you know, I'm looking at the ways that she used embodied theology and embodied wisdom, you know, how she used her hands, how she held wisdom in her hands. And she may not have known the best way how to, you know, exegete a Bible verse, you know, but the way that she lived her life, I argue, is a form of spiritual wisdom. And it's overlooked in many of our ancestors and our grandmothers because we look for, you know, that formal, quote unquote, wisdom.
Education, like maybe what's pejoratively or caricatured as like sort of the Enlightenment, cognitive, rational knowledge. And you describe how not only in other cultures, like Cuban cultures, Caribbean cultures, other Latin American cultures, but also Hebrew culture, where wisdom is contained in knowledge of creation,
right,
or knowledge of bodies, or even in just behavior, right? So like James even says, who's wise and understanding among you? By the good works of their life, let them show that they're how smart they are, you know?
Right,
And you describe, so I want to return to this body thing, because I think your grandma, you named that she made clothes, right? Mm-hmm. And that she had this tactile knowledge about how clothes should feel, and she could tell by touching them if they were made well or not. Mm-hmm. I wonder, I wonder if you could talk a bit about the fruit of honoring and valuing that kind of wisdom in a life. Like what do we miss if we don't, if we're not able to touch things like your grandma?
That's a great question. Well, I think, you know, something actually I'm reading, Yolanda Pierce's, In My Grandmother's House, you know, cause it's a definitely a sister book to mine. Not officially, but you know, and she talks about something that I just find so beautiful. And I think about this and, you know, now as I'm reflecting on my own book, but it's this idea of being fully present. And I think, and she talks about how, you know, so many of our ancestors who were trying to survive were fully present in worship, fully present in, you know, all these things. And as I was reading that, I thought, yes, you know, because I, like I mentioned, I talk about this idea of embodied theology and literally, you know, using your hands and sticking your hands in the dirt and, you know, and holding a mango. And what does that mean? What is that, you know, the weight of that in your hand, and all of these things. Right. And so, I think of this idea of embodied theology or just, you know, embodied and being fully present in all we're doing. And I think so much of, you know, as my grandmother sewed, you know, and we had, you know, I had never really thought prior to working on this book of how that was a form of spirituality. But I think about how she was fully present, fully embodied, and how she, you know, stuck that needle in that thread or that thread in that needle, and how she took the time and the intentionality to know not just my body and the measurements of my body and how to put things together to clothe me and care for me and love me, but how she did that for her community, right? She was fully present for her community and she met the needs of her community. I mean, her like I mentioned, her front door was constantly swinging open with women and men from the community. And yeah, and I feel like that is such a perfect example of what it means to use your hands, and to provide, right? Because as we read in the Bible, I mean, that is part of the Proverbs 31 woman, right? She provides for her family. So, you know, using your hands to provide and to create and to care and to be fully present and to all of these things, you know? And, you know, as I was reflecting on this story and as I was writing this book, I'm thinking about women like Tabitha in scripture. That's literally her story, you know? And we don't think of someone like Tabitha as someone who, you know, she's called a disciple. Yes. She is.
Yes.
Her life was worthy of resurrection. I mean, literally they call on Peter to come and resurrect her because she had died. And she's one of like three people in the New Testament that's resurrected. I think one of four besides Jesus, which I find so fascinating. Like, why did they want to resurrect her? And all we know about Tabitha is that she sewed and she made clothes for the women in her community. She met a need. She cared for. She was, you know, physically, as you say, tactile. You know, she was there doing the things. And so, yeah, I feel like, you know, these are overlooked things that we can learn from our abuelas, from our grandmothers, of how they use their bodies in those ways.
Yeah. I'm as you're talking about your abuelita, I'm thinking about, and I forget the reference, but I think the first time the scriptures reference the Spirit of God bringing a gift upon someone, I believe it's a tabernacle builder. Someone who's constructing a place for God to dwell. I can't remember the reference, but it strikes me that like the ancient Hebrews understood that people who made things were endowed with God's presence and power. And we've lost that. There's two places I want to go. I love the section about being a trickster and how this is a role that women can play in a patriarchal society and culture, and how basically, I don't know if this will get me in trouble. Basically, tricksters are like queering the power dynamics, and they really turn things upside down and inside out. And I want to return to that. Just putting that there, Ben, because sometimes my brain does weird things on me. But you have another section, and I think is tied to what we're talking about with your grandmother's hands, to quote another book, and that is like how women use their bodies in scripture, and how they use their bodies in as protest. And so you talk about a little bit about how Tamar uses her body as to basically show that she is more righteous than the righteous one. And then you also tie that to like the story that our culture tells women about their bodies. Could you just maybe explain that a bit and talk through how the insights that you got from that text and how that intersects with your own
survival is
own
complicated, life. You know, and that's something that I was wrestling so much with as I was working on this book is just how survival is complicated, particularly for women, in a society that's not, you know, in a patriarchal society. And I think about how survival is complicated for women in immigrant societies and for Black women and just for in societies that weren't, you know, weren't made for them. And I feel like that's something that I, you know, you have to really wrestle with when you look at the biblical text, because there are so many things that are there. And, you know, we kind of, we tell these stories, but I don't think we really sit in the gravity of what they mean and how women, you know, as you mentioned, are using their bodies in ways that, you know, nowadays we wouldn't, or maybe not nowadays, but dominant culture wouldn't celebrate or, you know. Right.
I mean, if you did this in youth group, you would get kicked out.
But these are women in the genealogy of Jesus. These are women who are called righteous. These are women, you know, whose stories they put their bodies on the line and change history, you know, Rizpah, you know, she didn't, obviously her story wasn't sexual, in nature, but she literally put her body on the line and she, you know, physically protested, injustice and it changed history. You know, God sent rain, which there was a famine for 3 years. Tamar, you know, as you mentioned, she, pretended she was a prostitute. I mean, all these things, all these ways that women are using their bodies, and I think that that's just something that is really important to name, that survival is complicated and that survival, and that I don't think that God is offended or whatever, you know, by the different ways that women are trying to survive. In fact, I see survival, this is something that kept coming up for me over and over again, that survival is sacred and survival is holy. And I think that, you know, that's something that we can really take from a lot of these stories, that, it's just sacred and holy. I mean, you think of the story of Ruth and Naomi and, you know, literally Naomi is like, go do this, go put yourself in front of this man because you need to be married because we need to live, you know? And that story is like so romanticized and, oh, it's so that, you know, but no, it's literally just a story of survival of two women just trying to make sure that, you know, they're not left destitute. And so I think that, you know, there's so many expectations, you know, to answer your question a little bit more, there's so many expectations put on women to be certain ways. And it's literally the opposite of what we find in the Bible. You know, I think for me as a Latina woman, you know, in the history of colonization and in Cuba and just in general, the way that a woman's body, the second that the colonizers arrived, you know, was sexualized and was labeled, you know, a lustful or a temptation or was labeled whatever, you know, and then literally forced into submission in different ways, whether through slavery or, you know, in different ways. But then you see, you know, so many places in the Bible where women through their sexuality are liberating people and liberating their communities and themselves. I mean, it really is such a contrast. And it's just something that I found so interesting in scripture.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I'm struck by that, that idea that there are the attempt to survive and the efforts that these women go through to survive is itself commendable because it affirms life.
Right.
You know, it's ultimately the most pro-life thing you can do to maybe say another phrase that might get us in trouble. But you know, I mean, that it affirms life to say, I want to keep living. I'm going to find a way to keep living despite the fact that my society or these laws or this is that like life is organized right now against me. But these stories of women in particular, finding a way to make it through, finding a way to survive.
Right. And they're called righteous and blessed. And, you know, they're in the story, the genealogy of Jesus, which is just so beautiful.
Yes, yeah, and God affirms this.
I think when we think of women trying to survive and the things that women have to go through in order to survive, we're not inclined to call them righteous, right? But yeah, but that's not what you see in the Bible.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
Yeah, and I want this to resonate a little bit longer. I'm gonna like be pedantic in how much we're focusing on this, because I think there's a lot of energy these days as people reckon with maybe purity culture, as people reckon with all the ways that the church hasn't helped them live into their sexuality, hasn't helped them relate to their bodies in a healthy way, hasn't led them to, you know, I did all the right things, I kissed dating goodbye, now I don't even believe in God anymore. Like, it hasn't served them well. So we've been fed these promises by people who have all the answers, and people are mad. And I think I want to say, I'm a clergy person, you have every right to be mad. And what I want to say is, I think what you do, Kat, in telling these women's stories and letting them be heard, rather than policed, is that you give us permission to celebrate how hegemonic, hurtful systems and structures are protested, rather than police the protest. And you let these voices speak to the evil, and then God says that the way they speak to the evil, which is the only way available to them, all Ruth can do is go present herself to Boaz. That's all she can do. And it's not something that necessarily, a pastor would say, this is how you get a husband today in 2021. This is what you do. You go find a but it's all she could do, and she's celebrated. And I think that we, and when I'm saying we, I mean like white dudes like Ben and I, like we need to celebrate this too. And maybe put down the batons and the tasers and just celebrate it. And Kat, your book.
That means so much. Yeah, no, thank you.
Me to do that.
And that's what I'm hoping that we can, you know, as we reflect on the most marginal in our society, that we can see their struggle for survival, you know, la lucha, as we say in Spanish. Not just a holy and sacred endeavor, but where we can meet God, really, really meet God, you know, where we can learn the most about God. If we're looking or, you know, looking at these stories and seeing how God is so, in the details, and God is, you know, again, blessing, you know, and whatever, however you want to understand that word, but if God is sort of blessing this struggle and the survival, and calling them righteous, and, you know, God is clearly in the midst and behind it. Man, what does that tell us about God? And what have we missed about, you know, who God is, or how we understand, the divine? And I think that, there's so much, to reframe and recalibrate and relearn about God, in these stories.
Yes. Maybe, we want to leave some of these stories for the reader as they get your book and study it. But I want to confess something. Maybe as we close, looked at the Canaanite woman. Is that Matthew 15? Matthew 17? Yeah, Matthew 15. You did not refer to her as the Canaanite woman. I have always heard her referred to as the Canaanite woman. But you referred to her as the Canaanite mother. And that was the first time anyone had ever done that for me. Now, this could be a judgment on my reading, right? My reading list needs to be refreshed. But you did two things. Mm-hmm. One, you tied her story to the genealogy at the beginning of Matthew's gospel, where he mentions four Canaanite women, right? And two, you call her a Canaanite mother, which I think humanizes her in a way that she doesn't often get humanized. And I think gives her dignity and honor in that conversation, based upon, I always thought it was a bit of a, an easy read to say that, Jesus was being dismissive to her. But Matthew, the gospel writer, has already told us how honorable and dignified Canaanite women are. And Jesus knows this. He knows his abuelita was a Canaanite woman. And so, the fact that in that text, I think as I read it, as you were doing, and I think there's a lot of legitimate readings of this text, but I read that Jesus was basically in front of his disciples letting this Canaanite mother teach them about what is prejudicial thought and what isn't. Like, what is godly and what isn't? And I just, the way you unpacked that and the way you told that.
Oh, no, thank you. I'm so glad.
Helped me a great deal.
Yeah, so, I love her story because, yeah, first of all, she's a mother. And that's something that I sort of tried to frame that. And I talk about, my grandmother as a mother in that chapter and how, yeah, I mean, mothers are going to do desperate things for their daughters. I mean, she's a mother that's caring for her daughter. And that's first. And second, about her story that just really stands out to me is how every time her story is told and retold, she's like the background of it. Like, it's not even really her story. The focus is, well, what did Jesus mean? And why did the focus is Jesus, and that's fine. Obviously we don't want the focus to be Jesus, and read the Bible, whatever. But I think that her story, she should be the protagonist, the protagonista. She deserves a little bit more attention. And I think because of the fact that at the end of her interaction with Jesus, he literally calls her a woman of great faith. And this is not something that he says a lot, at least according to Matthew, that he says a lot. In fact, right after, I always forget exactly where, he literally calls out his disciples and says, "You have little faith," So it's like these men who have been spending all this time with him are not understanding the things they need to understand. He tells them, "You have no faith." And here is this, what I call an abuelita theologian, who just appears, a desperate mother who is trying to survive. She's trying to, not just for her own survival, but for the survival of her daughter. And she's a woman of great faith. I mean, she literally has more faith than the disciples. Yes. And we never even focus on her when we tell her story. We focus on, well, what did Jesus mean? I just was so captivated by her as a theologian because she theologizes. She talks back to Jesus. She's saying, no, this is what I need and you need to give it to me. You don't want to, whatever, she kind of engages with him in what we call, theology in conjunto, theology in a reciprocal theological conversation. He engages with her in mutuality. He calls her, a woman of great faith. And she's like a triply marginalized woman, but at the same time, I wanted to set her up in that framework of what she really means, right? Like the Canaanite woman and how it's such a complex, her background is so complicated, but it's, there's so much there. There's so much there, more than just like, well, what did Jesus mean? Right.
Yeah. You can make a case that the best theologians in the Gospels, by Jesus's acclaim would be women, the Canaanite mother, the hemorrhaging woman, right? The Samaritan woman, of them receive much more acclaim.
They get it and they go off and do what they're supposed to do. And, they get it.
Yeah, this is really helpful for me too. I'm pretty sure as of this recording that I need to preach this passage from Mark's gospel.
There you go. So
anyway, I don't know if there's
Well, good thing you have a friend that's got a book that you could.
That is fantastic.
The book again is Abuelita Faith, What Women on the Margins Teach Us About Wisdom, Persistence, and Strength. Kat takes her story, her grandmother's story, the story of Caribbean, Latin American, Cuban people, and the story of women in scripture, and holds them together, I think, in a harmony that brings greater beauty than each story alone. So, Kat, thank you for this book. Thank you for your mind. Thank you for your theology and the work you're doing, the hard work you're doing. We have benefited greatly from it. I have, and I know our listeners will too. If people want to connect with you,
well, first of all, thank you so much for engaging so well with my book. Thank both of you for reading and engaging, and talking to me about it. I love hearing other folks, you know, what they've received from it, you know, because you write something and you put it out in the world and you're like, I don't know what people are going to think or what they're going to get from it. But anyway, yeah, if folks want to follow me, I'm primarily on Twitter and Instagram under @cat_Armus. Also my website, catarmus.com. And I have a podcast, as you mentioned earlier, called The Protagonistas, or The Protagonistas, where I just chat with women of color in church leadership and theology. So yeah, feel free to, you know, say hello in any of those platforms and those places. Great. Thank you.
We'll do it. We'll put links to all that in the show notes as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebbe, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online, as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.